You're always paying for something that was instead of paying for something that could be or is right now.
That freedom that you get to make choices about the impact that you want to have, about what direction you want to take your career, how you want to spend time with your family, it allows you to make choices about your priorities.
Welcome to the Rad Money Podcast. We're Rebecca
and Dylan, husband and wife and financial coaches for married couples.
Do you and your spouse want to reach financial freedom and start building wealth, but you're not sure where to start?
Have you tried to budget and pay off debt, yet you struggle to see your net worth actually increase?
Rad Money is the finance podcast that helps millennial married couples get on the same page about one of the toughest topics they will face in their marriage.
Our goal is to help you and your spouse work together to reach your financial goals and strengthen your marriage along the way.
Welcome to today's episode of the Rad Money Podcast. We're talking to Laura Lynch about how going tiny can get you to financial freedom faster. Laura Lynch is a certified financial planner who's in the process of moving into a tiny home herself. She focuses on helping people who are living in tiny homes plan for retirement, as well as helping people make the swap from standard living into a tiny home. We had a lot of fun recording this episode with Laura and learned a lot about tiny living. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Laura. We're so stoked to have you on the Rad Money Podcast. And just to introduce you to our audience, because one thing we talk about is how important it is to reassess your living situation. And you're just such a kindred spirit. I feel like we just really connected. So thanks so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about yourself. What got you interested in tiny living in the first place?
Yeah, super glad to be here. I did the thing. I did the path that we're all supposed to do, I guess. Got myself educated on first-time home purchases back in 2007, right before the Great Recession. I was originally in the Air Force, so I had come back to the U.S. and I'm like, okay, it's time to buy a house, right? And kind of got myself all up and ready for that. And then the Great Recession came and wiped out that value of that home because that was in Las Vegas. And, you know, I learned through the bumps and jives of the housing market that maybe putting all of your eggs in kind of that big roof is not really the best plan for creating a really sustainable and also resilient future. But I didn't really know that lesson. I hadn't really learned that until the pandemic and when we were refocusing our lives, as a lot of us did, and we realized, hey, this mortgage is making us feel fragile. It makes us feel like if our careers, you know, have a bump in the road, or if the supply chains have a bump in the road, whatever, we're still on the hook for this major mortgage. And so we really started to realize that this tiny house that we had built years ago could be a full-time living opportunity, and it would allow us to be debt-free and therefore feeling the ability to make more choice about what we do with our time and our careers and just making us feel more resilient in times of change. So tiny living started off as kind of a side thing, and then it's become our full-time thing. And now it is my career too. So it is everything to us.
That's so cool. I think it's really so interesting how I think one of the just the silver linings of the past few years is it's really forced all of us to just take inventory and reassess things. And I think we both of us can really relate to what you're saying about the mortgage being the thing that held you back. That's how we really just view like any debt, right? So your mortgage, credit card, your student loan, you know, all of these really big things are keeping you from being financially resilient, keeping you in that position, or a lot of people in that position of feeling very fragile and like they have to continue to just earn more money. And like they don't have these options, these choices, and these abilities to build any sort of wealth.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like that money people, which of course we all are, tend to really focus on good debt and bad debt. And I don't disagree with that notion exactly, but I do think that there's a psychological element that's not in that calculation of good debt and bad debt, right?
Absolutely.
That sort of freedom that you get being as close to debt-free as you can be to make choices about the impact that you want to have, about how what direction you want to take your career, how you want to spend time with your family. It allows you to make choices about your priorities instead of staying hooked into the priorities that were given to you. And so I think that psychological piece of it is not really reflected well in conversations about, you know, what is good debt and what is bad debt and leveraging debt to buy more stuff and you know, it just, you feel very weighted down by all of that. And then maybe you make choices that are more conservative or more safety related instead of really allowing yourself to expand into your purpose.
Oh, absolutely. I think like when you have debt, it's always focused on the past. And so you're always using that money that you have to deal with whatever it is that you paid for, whether it's student loan debt, your home, credit cards. It could be good or bad, but you're always paying for something that was instead of paying for something that could be or is right now. And when we got totally debt free, it just felt so good to know that every dollar that you bring in is money that's going into your pocket and you can use however you want. It's not going to someone else's.
They call it financial freedom for a reason.
Yeah.
Right? It's like you're not in servitude to your past self, to your past decisions, those sorts of things. So the sooner you can get there, the better. And I think that's one of the most attractive things about a living. It does help you decrease your cost of living. We're always talking about creative ways to bring down your housing costs. And I think it's something that a lot of people have really considered at one point or another. Where are you at in the process? So you said that you had the two properties and you're starting to lean into the tiny house more. So where are you at in the process?
I'm in the tiny house today because we're going to be here for a month. We're still continuing to work on sort of infrastructure tweaking because my stepson is also coming out here. And so we had to create a little bit more space. So our tiny house is kind of our basic living core. And then we have some ancillary buildings that serve other purposes. So I have a studio that's going to be built out. And then we have some other living space for my stepson. But it's April now. We're going to be here full time in June. We're just wrapping it up. The mortgaged house is on the market. And so we're just kind of waiting to get that sold. And then we'll be on our way full time into tiny living. It's been quite the journey, like 2.5 years of planning this out because it was a lot of logistics of properties and career pivots and lots of other things involved. So it's been kind of a long journey, but we're coming to the end.
That's so exciting. Yeah, I think I saw on your website like 30-month plan that you came up with. It's just so specific. It sounds so well thought out and amazing. And it's great that you guide people through this transition because there are so many things that they have to think of financially and otherwise. What are some of the financial benefits of going tiny?
Yeah, so the one that's most obvious is going to be just the overall cost of the living structure. Even if you buy like a really nice custom one, right, for say $150,000, which is, you know, just kind of a ballpark number because you can go higher than that. You can certainly buy a really nice one secondhand for less than that. But just as a ballpark number, that's 1/3 of the average price last year of just typical American dream house. And of course, national averages vary so much, right? We know that certain areas are a lot more expensive and certain areas are a lot less expensive. But just shrinking the overall cost of your home is huge because it just frees up so much more of that income. Then aside from that, you think about utilities, right? My utilities to keep myself heated and cooled. When you have a smaller footprint, you're going to have, you know, less utilities that you're using. Anything that you're insuring, right? If you have less stuff, less valuable stuff that you have to be worried about, that's less insurance cost. Just overall cost, all encompassing of shelter, right? Which is our just most basic need, right? On the Maslow hierarchy, shelter, food, water, right? These are very basic things. And so you can just reduce your overall cost, which allows you then to say, what am I going to do with this fuel, this energy, this resource in my life of my income? If I'm not going to be spending it on the most basic thing, then what can I build in my life that's going to be more impactful than the roof? So financial benefits, you know, largely is just the lower overall cost of housing.
Well, so it's obvious that the cost of a tiny home is much less. I didn't think about your utilities are going to be less. The insurance is going to be less. The loan terms are shorter too. So you'll be done paying off your tiny home sooner than a regular conventional loan. Is that correct?
Yeah. So to talk about lending terms, we have to understand that tiny homes are still in stages of legalization and that getting financing for a tiny home varies a lot in what you might have access to from financial products perspective. So there are mobile home mortgages available for tiny homes that are more like permanently placed. And so they would have a longer term and a lower interest rate. Then if you use like a personal loan to buy your tiny home, which there's personal loans, I think up to $100,000, your interest rate is going to be higher and your payback period much shorter. I've done a lot of the math on this and, you know, kind of compared like a mortgage at 6% on a traditional American dream house versus a personal loan for 4 years at a much higher interest rate. But because of the principal balance being so much less, meaning the purchase price being so much less, you can still keep that payment at about the same amount and you pay it off in, you know, 4 years or 6 years or whatever the term is. And so then from that point on, then all of the money that you would be spending on your principal and interest, you could be using to focus on other areas of your life that are more important. So yeah, the financing, it's not as easy as buying a regular house, but if you can figure it out, it allows you to get that home paid for so much sooner and then focus your income elsewhere, take a sabbatical or start a business or whatever it is that, you know, aligns with you.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I'd love to just follow up with that thought. If I'm understanding you correctly, essentially the benefit of the cash flow based off of what you just explained is more so after the tiny home is paid off instead of like an immediate relief. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on your personal situation. In our case, we built our tiny house ourselves, which is definitely a viable option. We built it over a year of Saturdays in our backyard, and there are a lot of DIYers out there. And so if you can build it with cash flow, then you have a completely paid off. If you're going to go and buy a custom built or a model tiny home and use financing, then you're going to have a delay, of course, on when your cash flow is going to be freed up. Then there's other options. If you're in a house that has some equity, then you can sell your house and use your equity. There's a lot of different ways to kind of make that change based on what's going on in your life.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I mean, even for me, but also I'm sure for listeners who maybe they're trying to figure out, like, could this be a benefit for me? And what would that look like? When would I start to see a return of any kind or see a payoff, so to speak?
I mean, that's incredibly quick, though. You're saying, you are just saying 4 to 6 years is a shit. When you think about your entire life and like the financial journey, it's such a small part of the journey to be paying. And then say the rest of my life, I could have been spending that money for another 25 years or so, but it's going in my pocket. I'm using it towards investing or whatever it is that I really want to do. That's incredible.
Yeah, but it requires that long-term focus.
Yeah, yeah.
And most people, I do think, need help increasing the ability to say, how is this going to impact my financial future in 5 years, in 10 years? Most people are looking very short term. So I think that's just a really important call out.
I think it's important. I was just getting some flashbacks on Facebook. You know how they remind you of what happened 12 years ago or 4 years ago. And I posted a photo 4 years ago when we had just gone into COVID lockdown. I was working from home. My husband was at home. It's a really uncertain time. That was 4 years ago. And just think about how that feels like just yesterday. And so, to your point, if you can accelerate getting yourself into a home free and clear in 4 years, then wow, you can really create more possibilities for yourself in your life. And that was exactly what happened to me as I was sitting there at that table at that moment going, I still have to pay for this house for 25 more years. Yeah. 25 more years that I'm going to have to pay for this house. And I have a house that I own free and clear that we built years ago. We could be living in that. Why are we not living in that? Right. So that was that perspective shift of short and long term.
So speaking of your career and that moment of realizing, okay, now we're working from home and different options are opening up, that really makes me just wonder, who is Living Tiny for? Who really makes up the tiny living community? What do they do for work? How old are they?
Yeah. So demographically, people living in tiny houses specifically is really broken down pretty evenly between folks that are in the early retirement or in retirement phase of life, people downsizing, their kids are gone, right? There's a chunk of people that on the younger spectrum, especially when you think about all the options of tiny living, right? People, there are 3 million people doing van life. Right. So lots and lots of people doing that, living in a digital nomad remote way. And of course, there's, you know, RV living, there's people house sitting full time, people Airbnb full time, like lots and lots going on in the no roof sort of or no traditional roof sense from a younger generation. And I would say people my age, I'm Gen X, we're stuck in the middle where we're still trying to figure out what our future looks like. And a lot of folks my age are still getting their kids out the door. And so they're kind of stuck in their house maybe a little while longer. But I'm really excited about the idea that folks that have been on the corporate ladder for a couple of decades who maybe are thinking about fractional work or consulting work or whatever, leveraging that home equity is really an opportunity for them to pivot their career with some freedom there. But it is pretty evenly split across all the generations. And it's a good solution for lots of people. Probably a little bit more challenging if you have a bunch of kids.
Of course. Yeah, that makes sense.
Just less space and more people equals not fun.
Just sounds like a lot.
Yes. But like us, right, we bought some land and put our tiny house here and we're, you know, kind of adding additional functional spaces around. And I do have, you probably have heard them already, I have two dogs in here that live in here just fine with us. They're 50-pound dogs. And, you know, you just create space and they get to run around outside. And that's the thing I think that's really important to think about with tiny living, too, is that it allows you and forces you to spend more time outdoors.
Well, isn't that something we all need nowadays?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that can be one of the biggest perks of it. I mean, you know, when we were on your show, Laura, you know, Dylan brought up the topic of heat mapping and just we don't actually even use all the space within our house. But then we also know that we're spending just way too much time indoors.
Yeah, like you look at a heat map, and there's only so many places inside the house that people are actually using. So out of a particular size home, people are only using like 25% of the space on a regular basis. And then things like the formal dining room, the formal sitting room, that guest room that you have just in case your family comes to visit never gets used.
And yet you're cooling and heating that space, right? How wasteful.
You're cooling and heating it. Yeah, in terms of sustainability, definitely not sustainable. But then none of us have enough time outside, right? You don't need more living space. Think outdoor space. How do I create these spaces so that I can get outside, connect with nature, return more to that as opposed to just more dark rooms with artificial lighting?
What were you saying too, Laura? Was this something I was reading that since, I don't know, whenever they started this one study, but home sizes continue to get larger, but the lot sizes get smaller and smaller too.
And so do family sizes.
Home builders are building bigger and bigger homes over time and families are shrinking. I write about this a lot on LinkedIn that, you know, families are shrinking, houses are growing. They are getting crammed closer and closer together out of necessity, right? There's not being made any more land. I heard a really great story on Marketplace on NPR. A typical starter home in the 1970s in, I think it was San Jose, California. And the price of it in the 1970s was like $10,000. And if you compound for inflation, that home should be $100,000 today. But it's $800,000 today.
Wow. That's insane.
And so it's not just rising costs that are driving up housing costs. There's a lot of other factors involved. And yet we are all born into this path that we're all expected to follow that involves a traditional American dream house and a college career and 2.5 kids and all the things. And we don't ever stop to question those preconceived notions that maybe worked in the past. Maybe they didn't work in the past. But in any case, we don't stop to question them. We just do what we think we're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And so it takes some critical thinking to decouple ourselves from expectations and instead align ourselves with our own vision and our own values about what we want our life to look like.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot harder than it sounds. All of my clients are not really used to thinking about their vision for their life and how to align their money with their values. Like those are all kind of new concepts that just unless you're intentionally practicing them, you don't really know how to do it, right? So you are going through life doing the things that you know to do, go to school, get the job, get married, have the kids, buy the house, whatever. But when you really stop and you talk to a couple and say, what is your vision for your life together? They're like, wow, nobody's ever actually asked us that. And we've never asked ourselves that. And so it's a really powerful thing. But another thing that I'd really like to talk to you about, Laura, since you're a financial planner and an advisor, when it comes to that side of things, of going tiny, the financial planning side of it, talking about retirement, what are some of the challenges or considerations that people need to think through when they're going tiny?
Yeah, I just recorded a whole solo podcast on home equity. I think that this is really tied up with those expectations that you talk about. And people have these really strong romantic notions around home equity and how home equity is going to solve all of your problems. And the truth is that home equity is kind of a forced saving strategy, right?
Yes.
housing market goes up and down just like any other market. But when you start paying on that mortgage, on that principal of your house purchase, and your house value goes up over time, if it does, which is not a guarantee, then you are kind of forcing yourself to save into a pool of funds that you can access later on down the road. But I think the key important thing to understand about home equity is that you never access home equity without paying more interest. So like I'm getting bombarded every week. I get a text, an email, or a phone call from my mortgage company on my house that's for sale asking me to cash out my home equity. If I were to cash out my home equity, they're going to take the principal balance that I owe on the house. They're going to add whatever I cash out. So I'm going to have a larger mortgage, and they're going to change the interest rate to current interest rates as opposed to my 3.25% from 2019. Therefore, my mortgage payment would go through the roof. And yet this is a multi-trillion dollar industry, the mortgage industry, and they have great ways of allowing us to take on more debt through tapping our home equity.
Of course.
It is only when you sell your house that you actually get your home equity out.
Yes.
And then maybe use it to buy a similar house or a larger house at that same market value. You're buying more house, so more mortgage payment. The only hack of that is to downsize. But home equity is a forced saving strategy. So for folks who are not able to say, hey, I've got a lower housing payment and that's going to allow me to save in my Roth, it can be a path, right, to creating some wealth for yourself. And so I think people have to know themselves. Am I going to be able to reduce my housing costs and save some of that? Or is it just going to, you know, encourage me to spend more? You have to know your own self-discipline around saving before you view downsizing as your tool to saving outside of home equity. And then another challenge, of course, is figuring out what happens in the long, long term. 70% of us are going to need some sort of assistance later on in life. So what does that look like for a lot of people? For example, you know, want to go into assisted living or something later on in life, they sell their house and use that equity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to be able to have someone help me out in this space, being that it's not exactly friendly for someone that's having mobility challenges? This is something for folks that are retired, that are downsizing. They have to kind of think about, what is my accessibility in my tiny space? I just got to write an article for Parade about granny pods, which are tiny spaces built to provide care for loved ones on your property. And those are built to be easy for mobility purposes. And downstairs bedrooms are very common in tiny homes now.
Very interesting. I love what you said back to the forced saving strategy of home equity and how folks think, oh, it's really common for people to think that your home is an investment. But this is something that I really like to challenge our listeners and my clients to think through, is that it is a piggy bank, but it's a piggy bank that you have to break to access that money. You have to move out of it, sell it, downsize, move in with family. There has to be some sort of strategy so that you can access that equity. Otherwise, like you said, it's just going to be in the form of a reverse mortgage or some sort of situation where you're just accruing more debt or paying interest. So it's the opposite of building wealth for future generations.
And I really appreciate what you said about the idea of understanding yourself. So if you are someone who's saving and investing as a heart, going tiny may not be the thing for you, because that's just more money to invest or save. So understanding yourself is really important. I think that's a great, great qualifier for people who are considering this as a long-term savings or investment strategy.
Yeah. Tiny living is definitely not the easiest. It is something that you have to like really be intentional about, but you know, it can really bring forward that financial freedom that maybe most people think they're not going to get until age 67 or 70, and create a much more rich and fulfilling life earlier on in life. And I think the majority of us these days understand that our life expectancy is not guaranteed. And we want to have a balance of both enjoying the richness of life and also being smart about how we're saving for the future, and just grinding it out till 70 to continue to put the biggest roof over your head as possible. I don't know. Maybe life could be richer sooner.
Isn't there a Socrates saying that, oh my gosh, I wish I could remember it perfectly, but essentially the idea is that we work super hard so that we can have the freedom that we could have had if we didn't work as hard. This is basically the point. It's like you were sacrificing all this good time now to work really hard to have freedom in the future. But if we just found the balance today, we could have that freedom now.
Yeah.
This is really what you're saying.
Yeah, I want that for people.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Laura. I'm a big fan of your podcast. Highly recommend anybody listening to this to go check out the Less House, More Moolah podcast and learn more from Laura. And Laura, where else can people find out about you and learn more about all the wisdom that you have to share?
Yeah, so my website is thetinyhouseadvisor.com, and advisor is spelled with an E instead of an O, A-D-V-I-S-E-R. And then I am probably most active on LinkedIn. And so there I'm at the Tiny House Advisor. I write a weekly newsletter there, which kind of explores all of these topics. I have a course coming out, which will be setting people up for that financial competency you're talking about to maybe go tiny, because certainly, you know, you have to kind of know where you are financially before you can launch off on that path. So working on developing that too. So lots going on, just really focused on this tiny living lever that people can pull in their life.
That's great. Wonderful. And we'll share all the links to your website and your LinkedIn in the show notes. And again, thanks so much for joining us. It's great talking to you today, Laura.
Yeah, it was a thrill. Thanks so much.
Now that it's just the two of us, Rebecca, I'd love to hear what you thought about today's conversation. What really stood out to you about tiny living?
I think the most interesting thing about it is the financing and the way that you really have to have a long-term view of what your goal is and why you're doing this so that you can A, make sure it's the right move for you, but B, you actually have to wait to get the real payoff. What Laura was saying was that because of the way that financing tends to work, until you have completely paid off your tiny house, you're really not seeing a benefit in that cash flow that we know is so important, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now you will see it a lot sooner than you would if you bought a regular average house with a regular average American mortgage, like she talked about, the $400,000 house. But it's important to know that like you're not going to really see a return on that benefit in the short term. It's a long-term move.
Yeah, that really stood out to me as well, was the fact that it isn't your monthly payment when you have the payments that makes a difference. It's that your house is paid off in 4 to 6 years. And that's incredible to think that that's all it takes to pay off one of these tiny homes.
Yeah. And I think it's just really interesting. Like if you are considering a move like this, you have to think a couple moves ahead. So you have to think, how long am I going to really be in this? What is the point here? What is the end that this is a means to?
Uh-huh.
So am I trying to just reach financial freedom, financial independence faster? Am I going to live in this forever? Is this just for a season? What is the point and what is the payoff? And just really making sure that you go into it with eyes wide open. And that's why it's great to talk to people like Laura, who like they're doing it. They're helping other people do it. And it's just such a unique thing. Getting some guidance, especially from the financial standpoint, I think is really worth it because you need to make sure that you're thinking about all the different angles. The other thing that really stood out to me is tiny living for elderly. So it
right.
sounds really great to downsize when maybe you don't need as much space.
What she called a granny pod?
Yeah. She talks about granny pods. I think that that's so interesting. But then just knowing that these tiny homes, like there's not as much equity that's accessible to you. Like you're
right.
not going to be able to do anything like that, which really isn't the best retirement plan anyways, as we all discussed. But I just think it's fascinating to think about how if you're planning on downsizing in your later years, how that might impact things like estate planning, it'll impact long-term care, all of those sorts of things.
Yeah. So that's the other thing that really stood out to me is that if you're going to go the tiny route option, you can't do the standard planning that people do for
totally.
Their retirement
because
totally. You can't rely on equity in your home. You have to plan differently. Like Laura was saying, the home is a forced savings account. So what are you going to do when you start to actually realize that extra cash flow 6 years down the road? That's really the thing that stood out to me being very important is knowing yourself enough to say, oh, if I do make this move, I'm going to invest so hard that I'm never going to think about money again by the time I'm in retirement. Because if you don't invest that hard, you could be setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah, I think to your point, there's a lot of special considerations that you have to think through. And I think that's really important, regardless of whether you're living in a tiny house or doing the nomad thing. Like there's just certain things that you really need to think about and you should financially plan for. You know, if I'm not spending this much on living, then what am I doing with my money to make sure that later when I don't want to travel as much, I can put down roots or I can do whatever's next. So again, this is just my takeaway. If you're doing something like this, you have to have a really, I think at least a 5-10 year plan for why you're doing it. And fully understand that. And that helps to have a sounding board like Laura, just to help you start to think through what the financial benefits would be.
Yeah, of course.
So that's this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please take a minute and leave us a review. It really helps our podcast get out to new listeners. But that's this week's episode. And until next time, I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Dylan.
And we're Rad Coaches.